Hello and welcome to the Channels podcast. We've got a bit of a different episode for you today. Joining us, rather than the normal Marcel, Chris and Phil lineup, we've got a bit of an episode where we're going to focus in on some of the cool new features coming in the future to Nextflow. And to talk to us about that today, we have Ben Sherman. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Everyone thinks of Nextflow as being a bit of a one-man project, you know, behind the enigma that is Paolo, but it's not just him anymore, right? I mean, tell us what you do.
Yeah, not anymore. I was a PhD student using Nextflow. I've been using Nextflow for 5 or 6 years now. I'm not actually a bioinformatician. I'm more of a machine learning, just HPC guy. But I was working with a lot of bioinformaticians. They got hooked on the Nextflow. So I got hooked on the Nextflow and I was writing pipelines for them. Ultimately, I ended up actually doing my dissertation about Nextflow, where I was running Nextflow pipelines and doing some stuff with like resource optimization. And then one day I stumble upon the Sakara website and I see that they want to also implement resource optimization. So I hurriedly try to finish my PhD before they can scoop me. And then I send them a research paper. I sent Evan and Paolo one of my research papers and said, hey, I'm doing this thing that you guys want to do. So why don't you hire me? And they did. It totally worked. super lucky for me. So anyway, I joined in November 2021, right around the time I was finishing my PhD. And I did end up implementing that. So if anybody's used the resource optimization in Tower, that was me. And then since then, I've just been getting involved in Nextflow development in general. And basically, my thing is like, I want Nextflow to be the best workflow manager in the world. And so I'm doing everything I can to try and make that happen. Rich, right now, the main thing is I'm basically just trying to turn myself into a duplicate of Paolo at critical to the project so that he's not the only one who knows everything that's going on. So over the past year or so, I've been studying the Nextflow code base, coming up with a list of like all these different things that we can build, things that we can make better in Nextflow. And so I'm very excited to come on here and maybe talk to you in a little bit about what's going on.
That's pretty good. There can't be many people who have sent in a job application saying I've literally written a PhD thesis on the thing I want to do at your company.
Yeah,
and it's good as well. Good to improve the bus factor for Nextflow. You know, if Paolo does get hit by a bus tomorrow, the project has some people living on who actually understand the code base. Yeah, so there's been you've kicked off quite a few kind of discussion threads on GitHub discussions on the Nextflow project. There's been a few kind of Slack threads popping up on the NF Core and Nextflow Slack channels over the past kind of 6 months or a year, especially. So it'd be great to we're going to invite you back a couple more times after this episode as well. But we've got three things lined up for today to talk about. Maybe you can kind of kick us off on the first one of those and talk a little bit about your vision for a new Nextflow command line interface.
Yeah, so this is something that has been talked about for a while now. There's an issue going back a while about, you know, hey, can we have like a regular, you know, GNU command line interface that sort of follows the same sort of conventions as most command line tools, you know, where like you've got, you know, double dash for long options and basic stuff like that. And so we're finally starting work on that. I've implemented it in Nextflow and there's a PR that people can go see. It's sort of in development / in review. And basically all it is just a new version of the command line. It's going to be a completely separate thing. So the existing Nextflow command line isn't going to go away or anything, but basically at some point we're going to include a new binary called NF instead of Nextflow. And that NF binary will be the new command line. The main thing is just that all the long options will have two dashes instead of one, just to be sort of, you know, follow that convention. And I think aside from that, there's maybe some little things, but I think that will also be a starting point for us to, in the future, if we want to add any breaking changes to the command line interface, we'll be able to do it through that new command line instead of the old one. So
for a bit of context here, let's talk about the pain points, why you people have asked for a different command line interface in the past. So for those of you, anyone who's listening is maybe not so familiar with Nextflow, you have kind of core arguments, which use a single hyphen, a single dash. And then we have double dash arguments, which are not for Nextflow itself, but for the Nextflow pipeline, right? So you have the parameters, the params. And if you say, if you define a variable within your pipeline code called params.input, --- input on the command line will then set that parameter. So what you're saying is that that's a bit kind of unconventional, I guess, between Linux programs having a single dash and double dash.
Yeah, it's sort of a Java convention, or at least was for a while, where with Java programs, every argument just had a single dash, regardless of whether it was short or long. And I think that's kind of fallen out of favor. People seem to prefer the double dash for long options and single dash for short, which I do as well. So, yeah, we'll make that standard. And then of course, at that point, the big question is, well, how do you tell the difference between a regular CLI option and a parameter? There's a couple different things we can do, but I think the main thing is that there's this convention that a lot of command lines use where you have just a double dash by itself and then you add parameters after that. It's a useful way to, if anytime you have something like Git or Docker where you're like running a command within a command, it's conventional to use that double dash to separate sort of like the inner command arguments from the outer command arguments. So you would say like NF and then any Nextflow specific options, and then you'd have a double dash, and then after that you'd put all your parameters, and so that's way it's clear, you know, which ones are which.
Yeah. And so are we gonna see both an option for long and short argument options for core Nextflow, where we, you know, instead of we have --- profile but also -p for the same thing, do you imagine?
Yeah, that's, I'm reviewing that. I want to add a short option for as many options as I can. So that's probably still in limbo a little bit. It's probably worth giving another once over to see, you know, which ones would it make sense. I think in the first iteration, Paolo wants to keep it as similar as possible, just a very basic, just port of the original command line. And then once we've got that in, there's a whole slew of things that we want to do, improvements that we want to make. So that would be one of them. Another one would be more consistent handling of list options. So, you know, there's different ways to pass list values in the command line. Nextflow typically just has a comma separated list, but there's also things where you just have space separated options or being able to specify an option multiple times. And then there's also a related issue around like parsing. So when you're passing in parameters, you know, passing in numbers, booleans, strings, maybe trying to improve the typecasting logic there, so that, you know, you don't enter like a string that happens to look like a floating point number and then it gets converted into a floating point number, things like that. That I think is technically independent of the command line and maybe more related to the configuration and how you define, you know, things like pipeline parameters, being able to annotate your parameters with types and stuff like that. But it's also a little bit tied up with, you know, the command line.
Yeah, absolutely. We're planning to invite on a couple of people in a future episode to talk about the validation of parameters and validation of types of parameters in the future. I think that's probably like deserves a whole episode in itself. Maybe, yeah, I'm biased on that. It's, you and I have talked about this in deep detail before. But no, I mean, it's coming from a community side, certainly it's like almost a running joke in the community about how easy it is to accidentally do --- name or --- profile instead of just a single dash. Like we have Slack autoresponders set up for this bug because it comes up so often. So fixing that would be great. But I guess what we're trading off for is that people are now, the order of arguments is going to start mattering where previously it hasn't. So that's going to be something that we need to look out for.
Yeah, it will. This is one of the interesting quirks with this new interface. I don't know how common it is for people to do this, but It is also possible to pass positional arguments to Nextflow through a Nextflow pipeline. So just like giving it values and then being able, there's like an args variable in your Nextflow script. You can say like args sub zero, args sub one, so on and so forth. I think it's more common for people to use parameters because it's nice to have, you know, name-based parameters, but that's also possible. And so we have to like make sure that's an example where the order matters, where you have to put your positional args first, if you use them at all, and then your parameters and all this stuff. So yeah, the order is definitely going to start mattering a little bit.
Sounds simple, but when you dig into it, it's a Pandora's box. Yeah. And so final question on this. We're going to have a new command, you said, NF instead of Nextflow. Long term, is the plan to replace the Nextflow command with the new CLI? Or are we just going to sort of, how long are we going to keep these two different ways of running the command line in parallel?
I don't think we know yet. I think we just need to get the new CLI out there and get people using it, get feedback about it. And then, you know, we'll just have to see. I imagine it'll be a similar process that we did with DSL 1 and 2, where both are going to exist for a long time, but maybe new features at some point will only add new features into the new CLI to encourage people to go that route. And then maybe one day far into the future, we'll get rid of the old one. But, you know, it's not really hurting anything to keep it around. So as long as people want to use it, we'll probably keep both options open.
Gonna have to update some documentation and training, I guess, but that's not the end of the world.
Yeah, eventually.
Great. Cool. Okay. Next on my list here is job arrays. Care to kick us off and tell us what this is all about?
Yeah. So here's one that people have been asking for this for a long time. And for a long time, Paolo and I think we both thought that it was not. It just wasn't something that was ever going to happen in Nextflow because it just seems kind of antithetical to the paradigm that Nextflow takes. You know, in Nextflow, we really try to make every individual task completely independent of all the others. And that makes it very easy to, you know, give a sort of a generic task definition, and then you can run it anywhere. You can pull your data in from anywhere and it just works, and you don't have to worry about different tasks waiting on each other or interacting with each other, things like that. But Paolo had an idea a few months ago with the job arrays, because people just kept pushing it, not only with the HPC clusters, but also AWS Batch has a concept of job arrays, and then Google Batch as well. He had an idea where, what if we just had like a special executor called an array executor, where basically it takes in the tasks like normal, but it just adds this one simple behavior where it waits until it has 100 tasks, say, ready to go, or 1,000, or however much the user specifies. And then when you have a whole batch of them, it just submits them all at once using the array job syntax. And I was like, all right, I think that might work. So I went ahead and started implementing it. And so we did that and it worked. And then that was a good prototype, but after that, we pivoted and decided this would actually be better as a process directive, because it was kind of a weird setup. We were saying like, okay, you have this array executor, and then you have to specify a target executor on top of that. And it was kind of complicated in terms of the configuration. What if we just had a process directive called array, and you just say array 100, and then, you know, that process will just submit jobs as arrays. And so we did that. And then after that, it's gone through a couple different iterations. You know, originally, just I'm kind of getting into the weeds of like how I implemented it. You know, basically, I tried to implement it in a very modular fashion so that it wasn't getting all interleaved with existing code, right? It was just kind of its own thing. Eventually, we found there was a way we could do it just baked into the code. It doesn't add a lot of code duplication or anything, and it's really nice. So like I said, it's basically just a process directive. You just say array and you give it the size that you want. And then if an executor supports array jobs, then it will do that. It will basically block until it has a full batch, and then it will submit the entire batch as an array job. And the interesting thing to understand about array jobs that I didn't understand until I really dug into it, I thought it was just like a regular batch job, like you just submit a batch and then it all exists. But it's really just a special kind of submission strategy. It's just a special way to submit a ton of jobs that look exactly the same, so that the submission itself is a single job rather than, say, 100 separate jobs. But then once you've submitted the array job, the individual child jobs behave exactly like regular jobs. They could get launched independently. They could complete on their own time. They might not even be all run at the same time. They could be run at any time. They have their own status, all this stuff. And so once you've handled the submission of the array job, everything else works exactly as before, which was really nice in terms of the NextFull implementation. So,
yeah. So what's the reason for doing job arrays? If why can't NextFlow just fire off 1,000 jobs if they're all run on the cluster independently anyway? What's the difference? Why do people want job arrays?
So there's two main advantages. One is that it's a lot less overhead on the scheduler, especially for HPC schedulers, because, you know, if you're an HPC scheduler, every time you receive a job submission, you have to immediately do something with that, right? You have to save a record somewhere at the very least. So if you get a million jobs, even if you can defer all those jobs to later, you still have to, you know, save every single one of those jobs to your database. And so, you know, if you're submitting like 1,000 jobs all at once, or imagine tons of users doing this across an HPC system, you can quickly overwhelm the scheduler. So at its core, it's just a very basic efficiency gain on the scheduler, where instead of saying, hey, I've got 1,000 jobs that are all different, they're all special snowflakes, you got to deal with all them separately, you're just saying, hey, I have a batch of 1,000 jobs, but they all look exactly like this. There, here's a template. And then, you know, if all you need to do is plug in an index, and then you'll get the actual job. So it can save a single record for the array job. And then later on, it can go and submit those child jobs on its own, at its own pace, without, so it's just, it isn't as overwhelmed. The second advantage is that when you give the scheduler all that information, that gives it some more opportunity to do backfilling. So HPC users might be more familiar with this than others, but basically backfilling is a strategy that a lot of schedulers use, where you have say you have a queue of all these different jobs. Some, maybe you have like a few really large jobs and then a bunch of small jobs. Backfilling is basically a strategy where you sort of try to fit in small jobs in these little gaps that exist between large jobs, so that you can fill in these small jobs without taking up a lot of space. Kind of similar to the concept of, like, if you were to fill a jar with like a bunch of big rocks and then small rocks, right? You'd put in the big rocks first, and then you'd put in the small rocks, and they'd fill in all the gaps. That's kind of how backfilling works. And so the general principle is, the more information you can give the scheduler ahead of time, the more efficient it can be with its backfilling. Now, NextFlow, because of how dynamic it is, NextFlow usually doesn't know that much ahead of time, you know, what kind of tasks are going to be executed. But if we have this array job concept, at the very least, we can submit, NextFlow can at least tell the scheduler, like, hey, I'm going to need these 1,000 tasks executed. Do with them however you want. And that's going to be a lot more efficient for the scheduler than NextFlow, like, constantly, you know, pinging the scheduler 1,000 separate times, like, hey, new job, new job, new job. So I'd say those are the main two benefits.
And the resources always have to be the same within it. So this is always going to be defined for a single process. Is that right? You can't say do a job array with these six different processes, which have slightly different requirements. It's always going to be on a single process level.
Yeah. So basically, any of the parameters related to the job submission, like resources, the queue, wall time, things like that, those will have to be uniform across the array job. Because of how NextFlow implements its array job, the way it works is that basically NextFlow submits the job script. The array job script itself is actually just NextFlow defines, you know, just gives a list of all of the individual task scripts, and then it just plugs in an index and runs the script at a given index. So every task still has its own task directory, its own task script, its own wrapper script. And that means that any sort of configuration that is defined in the wrapper script, the command.run, for anybody who knows what I'm talking about, that stuff can still be different across different tasks within a process. I don't know how common that is, but, you know, edge cases like that will work. But yeah, things like the container in theoretically could be different unless you're running on AWS Batch, in which it would have to be the same. So yeah, there's a weird gray line there between things, but in general, the general principle is if you define it in the submission script, then it has to be the same. Yeah. And so that sort of puts a basic boundary where like we probably will only do array jobs within a particular process, you know, just because if you tried to make an array job across different processes, you know, it's just very unlikely that you're going to have processes that happen to have the exact same resource requirements, the exact same container, all that stuff. So
two final questions. Firstly, if you say batch these into 1,000 jobs, but I run a pipeline and this time it only has 30, that's not going to be a problem. I guess you have some kind of logic about poison pills when a channel is empty. Is that right?
Yeah. So this actually prompted a really good, a really important innovation that turns out to be useful in a lot of other contexts, like our third topic, which we'll get to. But basically what you need to know, what Nexhill needs to know is when has a process created all the tasks that it's going to create, and which I call it, when is a process closed? Meaning it's not finished, but it's created all the tasks they're going to be. Once that event happens, the array job collector can basically say, okay, well, I'm not going to get any more tasks. So whatever tasks are left over, I'll just submit that as a incomplete or as like a partial array job. So, yeah.
And the final thing I wanted to clear up is we've also, one of the things that's been requested about a lot is task batching, where you have a small task which might only take 5 or 10 seconds to run. But if you're running on, for example, a cloud where you need to spin up a new batch environment or something, it might take minutes because you've got to spin up the environment to run this 10-second job. Mm-hmm. And so people sometimes ask for task batching of collecting all these together and running them in one go. This is not that, right?
Yeah, I'll speak on this briefly because task batching is a whole other can of worms that we should talk about another time. But yeah, there's the key difference here is that in task batching, and we're working on this as well, is the same idea. You would say like, okay, I want a batch of 1,000 tasks, but instead of launching all the tasks individually on their own, you know, compute resources and all that, you would actually just invoke a single job that just loops through all, just executes each task one after the other. And so in that case, they actually do all execute in one block. And I guess the important difference there is that with an array job, because the child jobs are independent, if say one of the child jobs fail, well then all the other child jobs could still succeed on their own. And Nexhill can just retry that child job in another array batch, right? Or just array, we're throwing around all these different grouping words. In a batch job, like a task batch, or I call them a task group, I think is the terminology we're going to use. If any one of the tasks fail, then we'll see what we can do, but it looks like we'd have to redo the entire batch because of how it works. So, and again, we'll have to see. It might be possible to actually still, actually, I think it's still possible. I think even if one of the children fail, the rest of them should be able to be recovered, hopefully. But yeah, so there's a slight difference there. Yeah, the task batching is definitely useful for when you have lots of small tasks that are really short running. And so, you know, you want to amortize the VM startup and tear down costs, right? So yeah, we're gonna do that too. And then the real question then is, can you use task groups and task or in array jobs at the same time? I don't know if anybody's going to do that, but I'd like to see
someone will. Someone will. You can guarantee that. You know, if someone out there is going to try and break it. Awesome. All right. And now onto our third and final point now. And this is probably one of the most requested items I've ever seen on any of the Nexhill community Slacks or NF Core Slacks, I think, which is to do with not generating data, which is usually what we talk about here, but deleting data. So, I mean, there's this kind of semi-hidden feature config flag within Nexhill called cleanup true, where when the pipeline finishes running at the end, if everything went well, it can delete all the intermediate files from a work directory. But this is something slightly different, right? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we're just gradually escalating. Each thing is just more and more like highly requested features. We're trying to knock them all out. But yeah, so there's an existing option in Nextflow called cleanup. It's called the cleanup option. And basically what it does is if your pipeline completes successfully, Nextflow will delete all of the task directories that were generated by that workflow, with the idea that, like, well, if it's assumably you have published all of your outputs to somewhere else, and so we can delete all these task directories, all the little files they create. It's actually, fun fact, it's actually broken right now on any of the cloud providers like S3 because of a bug with the shutdown logic, which I've got another PR to fix that. But even if that works, the problem with that is that you have to wait for the entire pipeline to finish before it happens. And so a problem that a lot of people run into is, you know, it's typical for a pipeline, at least in my experience, where you give it some input data, it generates a ton of intermediate data that's maybe like orders of magnitude larger, and then it generates some final output that's way smaller. And what we would like to be able to do is to delete all those intermediate outputs and just have the final outputs. This is actually something I encountered as a Nextflow user. I was working on a RNA-seq pipeline called GemMaker, basically the same thing as the NFCore RNA-seq pipeline. But one of the problems we ran into was that at the stage where it generates all the BAM files, we didn't have any sort of limit on the parallelism or anything. So we were just running as many tasks as possible. So I would launch like thousands of tasks. And then once they all got to that stage of generating the BAM files, I actually exhausted our like 150 terabyte scratch storage at my university cluster. You know, the admins were emailing me, say like, hey, well, there's 32 megabytes left on our scratch drive. Could you like delete some files, all that stuff? Eventually we implemented or my colleague, Stephen Ficklin, he implemented a very clever hack in Nextflow where we would delete the files. Well, we would delete the file contents, but leave the file marker itself. So it was basically an empty file, but we would preserve all the timestamps and even the size. So you could have an empty file, but you could set it to have a particular size. They call it a sparse file. And so then when you resume the pipeline, Nextflow would see all those output files and think, oh, well, these files haven't been changed. As far as I know, they're good. And so it would cache that task. And that worked because as long as you had all the downstream outputs still there, you could cache that run. And that worked for, you know, on a basic level. But of course, what we really want is maybe we should try to do it the right way, the proper way. And so we're trying to implement that in Nextflow now. And so now the idea is, okay, I have this task that generated some output. Let's say it generated a BAM file. If I can figure out all of the downstream tasks that are going to use that BAM file, then I can say when all of those downstream tasks are done and their outputs exist, I can go back here and delete this BAM file. Now, can we do that automatically? In GemMaker, we sort of wired everything manually. So we had all these like signals going from processes to downstream processes. And then we were like combining them and sending them all into this like one delete process. So basically, like, could we just implement that logic in Nextflow, where Nextflow could just scan your pipeline DAG and just figure out all those dependencies? And this is where that thing I talked about earlier came in handy, which is the idea of, again, for this, we need to know when has a process created all the tasks that it's going to create. Because once that happens, then you have the full set of tasks that could possibly use this file. So going back to that BAM file, I generate a BAM file. I can look at the process definition for that task and I can inspect the DAG and I can figure out what are all the processes that could possibly use this BAM file, looking on like how the channels are connected, right? And then I can say, okay, I'm going to watch all those processes. I'm going to wait until all those processes are closed, right? So all the tasks that can exist have been created. And then I will go and inspect all those new tasks and figure out which of those tasks are using the BAM file. The way this works is that if you go into your work directory, into the task directories, and you look at how all the files are created, for a given task, the input files of a task are all just symlinks. They're all just symlinks into, you know, some upstream task that deleted it. So you can even do this yourself manually. You can go into a task, look at the input files, look at the symlinks, and you can see which tasks they came from. Now we're in Nextflow, we don't have to do that because we already have that information, but basically that's all it is. We find all the tasks that are using a particular output file, and then we add them to a list, and then we wait for those tasks to finish. And when they're done, we go back and delete that file. And so then after that, it's just a matter of repeating that for all of the files that exist, or all of the output files as they're generated in real time. I'll stop there for a moment in case you have any other questions. It goes deeper than that.
It's quite a rabbit hole. It's another one of these ones where I feel like someone suggests it and the first time you hear it, it doesn't sound like it should be that difficult, just clearing up as you go along. But when you really start digging into it, you need to make sure you don't delete too early, because that could cause downstream tasks to fail, or delete too early because then it's going to break the resume functionality. But with this, your resuming should still work, right? You should be able to still skip through all those cache as long as you haven't changed the pipeline to invalidate the cache halfway through. What happens if you do that? If I edit the process block or something halfway through, and those files, then the pipeline has to know that that's changed at that point in the DAG, and I need to start again.
Yeah. So in theory, I haven't implemented this yet, but the theory is here. Nextflow should be able to use that same logic that I just described for figuring out the lifetime of a file to also figure out whether a task can be cached, even if its output files have been deleted. And so the idea here is that suppose you're resuming a run, you're trying to cache a task, you find that the task is in the database, there's a record for it. So you know it's been run, and you know it completed successfully and all that stuff, but you can't find the directory for it because it was deleted by this automatic cleanup, right? Well, then what you could do is if you have that same information about, okay, all of these downstream tasks, here are all the downstream tasks that used this particular task. We don't currently save this stuff in the Nextflow cache database, but we could. And so if we did that, we could then go, okay, look at all those downstream tasks. If they are cached, then we can also cache this upstream one and then keep going. And then this quickly becomes like a recursive process, because you could look at those downstream tasks and run into the same situation again. We're like, well, these were also deleted. So now I got to go look at all of their downstream tasks. And so now you're walking down this increasingly widening tree, right, of task dependencies. But as long as you end up at a leaf node at the end, as long as all of those little trails end up at an actual file that exists, then you could keep going. And so that's the situation that would happen if, say, you were running a pipeline and you got halfway through and then maybe something failed and caused the whole workflow to crash, or maybe you canceled it for some reason or another. But even though it's halfway through, it's already deleted a bunch of tasks from the beginning. So then, but it will not have deleted any tasks that were still being used, right? So if you were then to resume the pipeline, it would find all these missing tasks, but it would be able to find all of their downstream tasks and then recover them. Now, if a task didn't finish, then it's not going to be recovered, right? And then similarly, if before you restart the pipeline, you change a bunch of stuff in your pipeline code, you might end up invalidating some stuff. I think the basic idea is, as long as you don't change your your process definition, it will be resumed. But if you change anything in your process code, it's probably not going to be recovered, which is the same as a normal operation, right? The main change that we're implementing here is that basically, instead of using the work directory to cache tasks, we're just going to do it all in the cache database. So if you know this, there's this .nextflow folder that Nextflow creates. And in that folder, there's a cache database. There's a bit of redundancy there between this little cache database and then the tasks and the work directories. Technically, you really only need one or the other. And so I think what we're going to move towards is just, let's just cache everything in the Nextflow cache. That's a lot simpler than having to have, this giant work directory. You don't know which folders within there can be deleted or not. Well, just put it all in this one little database file, and then you could delete your entire work directory if you wanted to. And then it should still be able to recover everything that it had before, something like that.
Sounds good. I think it's going to make a lot of people very happy. It's also going to be really, really good for people running massive pipelines, because Because as you say, the more samples you add in, the bigger the bulk size, the peak intermediate file size, and also the longer the pipelines run for, so the longer you have to keep all that around. So I think this is definitely going to be something that enables people to scale the volumes of a single pipeline run rather than having to break stuff up. And also people who don't have access to such big systems. You especially have that with people where like, I've got a server, I don't have an HPC cluster, I don't have the cloud, I've got a server and it's got like a disk with this many gigabytes. Like these people are going to love this feature. But right. Honestly, I think a lot of people are going to start using this by default if it works as well as you promise.
Yeah. Well.
I mean, what's not to love? Yeah. Brilliant. Ben, we've been talking for a while, so I think we probably need to wrap up. But thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Like I say, we're gonna bring you back a few times, I think, because it's clear that there's a lot of cool stuff lining up on the Nextflow roadmap, and it's really really exciting to hear about the direction that things are going in, and kind of I think a lot of people will be keen to find out what they can expect from future releases of Nextflow. So yeah, massive thank you for your time.
And please feel free to bring me back anytime you want. I've got all kinds of things I could talk about. So
for sure. I'll sort of say as well that anyone listening, Ben is on the Nextflow Slack as well. So drop any questions you've got into the channel's podcast Slack channel on the Nextflow Slack, and we can continue the discussion there. Otherwise, hope to see you again in a couple of weeks, everyone who's listening, where we'll be talking about what have we got in the next one? See if I can find it quickly. I think I haven't got it scheduled up, but I'll drop the topic into Slack anyway, so you can see what's coming up. And thank you very much for your time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Cheers.